This is Toronto Today with Greg Brady.
Toronto's news, today's talk.
640 Toronto.
Sheba, here's the headline. I found the story interesting, and you, maybe you've got the same lens, different lens, slight tweak. Here's the headline. Hate crimes in Toronto down slightly from year before, still higher than pre-pandemic. That's from police. And I'm just shocked by the low numbers. And I know we're supposed to do this, and I think we should do this when there's something awful that happens, clearly that involves violence. It's a massive story. It tears at all our hearts, and it's not a great day. It's not a great day when you got to tell people it's the anniversary of something. We just did that with the Toronto van attack. We'll do that early next month with the horrific, pickup truck murder of five members of that family in London, Ontario, who were just out for a walk. But the numbers I look at, I'm like, don't you think if you just paid attention to the media and Twitter and endlessly, numbers have gone down. Reported hate crimes in the biggest city in our country are down from 257 to 242. And they document that 91 of the 242 were motivated by race, ethnicity, and nationality. Look, I'd like it if it were zero. But I just think if you'd said to me, honestly, if you'd said to me, Greg, how many do you think there? I'd be like, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000, like six or seven a day. These are just complaints, right?
I agree. But you know what? This leads me to believe that not everything is being reported.
I agree with you there.
Because for it to be this low, there's no way there. I mean, I hear about an incident, someone on social media, someone, you know, a friend of a friend, something happens to people. It cannot be this low. So I just don't believe things are being reported. And of those, I'd say a certain percentage were motivated by race, ethnicity, and nationality. And from that, half were targeted to members of the Black community. So these stats, they're very detailed, but I just don't think it shows the entire picture of what's happening in the city.
I agree. So I think we're of two minds here, and we always use the phrase. I mean, you could name the show it, you know, often two things are true. I think we're never as divided and never it's never this, oh my goodness, it's a tightrope to leave my house every day. Someone will roll down their window and scream at me. I think we're in a better place. I think neighbors like each other. Something happens, a big snowstorm or a cat goes missing, and people just get together and they help each other. I really think there's more good than bad in our whole universe and on our streets.
I agree. Yeah.
That said, to your point, you've raised the point before, and I think this is true. Let's say on public transit, some guy, because it's going to be a guy, harassing a woman. Well, I strongly doubt every woman's dialing 911 going, okay, let me tell you my story.
No,
or let me go down to the police.
Not.
They're just like, but I get the anger. They'll come home and tell their husband. They'll go home and tell their boyfriend. They'll call their parents if they're a younger student. And it's outrageous to me, but I get it. You're like, what's anyone going to do? They'll believe me more than likely, but what's the end game here? What do I want? Do I want to get scrutinized? Maybe they don't. And so they don't. You've said it before. So many women have dealt with some jerk either showing them something or making something, some kind of suggestive look to them on transit.
Right. Every single woman after a certain age, and at that age, I would say is a very young age, every single woman has been through something that she didn't want to be a part of, related to a male.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's much doubt about
that. And we're not
that.
Reporting that. What am I going to do? Report it? Because someone, you just said it. Because someone said something to me on the TTC, on the GO train. Somebody said something to me at the grocery store. I'm not reporting that. I'm not letting that take up any more time in my day. You know, the inconvenience of just having to file that report. And obviously, it depends on the severity of the crime. Some things should absolutely be reported. But in certain circumstances, no. Even if I'm called a racial word, right? I'm a person of color. If I was called something that I deemed as racist, yeah, I still wouldn't report it. I just can't be bothered. What's the point?
Yeah, I know. I think I wonder if we all have that line where we'd step in, right? If your kid was called the name at school, if my kid was bullied and harassed at school, then I'm like, you know what? Now it's time to, you know, now it's time to call the principal and find out what's going on there. Now it's time in some cases to involve the authorities. But to your point, you're right. All of this stuff is underreported. But I do think, you know, we look and there's constant stories, right? There's somebody's put a swastika on a kid's locker at a school. There's been a mosque, an incident in a mosque parking lot. It does feel like it's all around us sometimes. This gives me only the slightest sense. I'll give the number again. 242 reported hate crimes in a city of 4 million people.
No way.
In a year. Of course, there aren't that many. And that's just the reports. So there is somebody who may make a call when somebody rolls down a window and yells. The person yelling, yeah, I wish that person wasn't doing that. I wish that person wasn't in our midst and in our community. But it's that's not get, 9 times out of 10, I bet you that's not getting a phone call to 911 or to a police station. So it doesn't mean it's not happening.
No, of course it's happening. And 91% of it, like I said, is motivated by race, ethnicity, nationality, according to the study. And it just makes me wonder, I mean, since, you know, our London family, since that attack, I think we've all had so much more of awareness and we're talking about it more. I don't believe these numbers are accurate. There's no way in the population that we have, we're just not reporting it. And I think, I mean, you said it. I think it happens more, if you're going to say men or women, I think more women deal with the harassment, but the hate crimes can go across anybody and everybody, depending on where you are and what you do.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. It's unfortunate. And it's just not an accurate depiction of what's happening.
It's not. And I saw, like, even 2 days ago, I know it's Pride Month is next month. And we had the conversations about the Pride flag with a couple different guests in the last few weeks. But just it kind of went by quietly. 2 days ago was the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, Biphobia. And I look up just data and Canada is like one of the greatest countries to be homosexual in. Like, I don't know how else to say it. It's one of the safest. There's anti-discrimination legislation. Marry who you want to marry. Adoption, transgender rights, intersex rights. Like everything sort of, I know,
but
it feels
like that. Hate crimes will still happen.
Hate crimes will still happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, we are very forward-thinking and very, I don't like the word tolerant because we don't need to tolerate anybody. But, you know, we are accepting more than other countries, but we have a long way to go.
We've got a long way to go. And look, it's like I'd even make the case that gender identity and transgender, it's complex. I think, yes. I think most people favor love who you want to love, be who you want to be, identify how you want to identify, and we've got your back when it comes to discrimination. Can I ask a question about adult sports or medical care for 14-year-olds? Can I ask those questions?
You need to.
I think I can.
Greg, you need to. You need to. The position that you're in, you are one of the main people who should be asking those questions, and not because of any type of
it's not a bias or discrimination. No,
that's it. It's because there's a responsibility there. It's an education as well for you, for me, for anybody who's listening. These conversations absolutely need to happen.
Thank you. Part of the reason, part of the reason we got to where we are in the 70s and 80s is people said, I don't know, like what's wrong with two men marrying and raising a child together? They asked those questions when it was unpopular to ask those questions back then.
This is Toronto Today with Greg Brady.
Toronto's news, today's talk.
640 Toronto.
Paul Johnson is a global BC reporter. He's worked all over the place. He's worked in the States, worked in Washington, D.C., which is in the States. The story was about prescribed opioids being sold on BC streets. And I spoke to him yesterday about this. I wanted to start. He got a ton of response to this particular story. And I think there's a window here and a lens for Toronto. And there's certainly a lens and a lot of debate about safe supply, safe injection sites. What it decriminalization versus enforcing drug laws. Here's our conversation. I mentioned that it's been an incredibly responded to story.
I mean, certainly, you know, a lot of people were watching this story. Normally, a local news story that I post gets between 50 and 100 views. This story I posted after we ran it on Monday night, and it's had 50,000 views. Yeah. So this hit in a way that was on a higher order of, you know, a lot of the other reporting that we've done. You never know what makes something go viral in this day and age. There's a lot of components to it. But I can surmise one thing is governments are really desperate, and rightly so, to do something about the overdose epidemic. They just released new numbers here in British Columbia today. The tragedy continues. Another tragic, record-breaking month here in the month of April for overdose deaths. They need to do something to stop it. You know, this is new territory.
Yeah.
Public health systems have not dealt with this level of use of dangerous opioids and drugs that are as powerful and as dangerous as fentanyl and the fentanyl derivatives that are laced with all kinds of new drugs that show up all of the time. And they really need to do something. and they're trying new and different things. There's a lot of controversy about whether these things are working or not. And people are really paying attention to this. And so I think that speaks to why there's been such high consumption of this story.
So, Paul, BC has put in an exemption, and they put it in what at the end of January, and it'll run to the end of January of 2026. So we're not even 4 months in to it. Is there any way, I want to talk about some of what you saw anecdotally for sure in your story, but is there any way to dig into numbers, which you just mentioned? I mean, there's two sides, right? The idea is this is a crisis. We hope the decriminalizing possession, but not legalizing possession, helps the crisis. Some are going to say you're making it worse. You're saving lives and making it better and extending at least out the process. But there's just a lot of divided opinions, and we're not even 4 months into a 36-month project.
This is one of the most divisive issues in North American politics I've ever covered. I worked in the United States for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I covered abortion battles. I covered gun rights battles. This is right up there. For Canada, this is the equivalent of our gun control debate. People have really dug in positions on this. And, you know, it's, I mean, talk to doctors for one. That's just one aspect of the reporting that we've been doing. We hear doctors who say safe supply, which is one component of how they're trying to address this opioid disaster and reduce the death toll. There are many doctors we talk to who say safe supply is working. I have patients. I prescribe hydromorphone, dilaudid pills to them. They take these instead of going out and getting fentanyl on the street. It's saving lives. But there are other doctors, and I've spoken with many of them. Many of them feel that it's too controversial for them to speak publicly, but they'll talk to you off the record. And they're also veteran addictions doctors, and they disagree. They say the way forward is treatment, and is persuading and compelling in ways that, you know, we don't even really yet know what to do, but getting people into treatment and getting them off opioids is the way forward. And they highly disagree with the safe supply program. They say putting more drugs into the population is not the solution. We need to do less. So we're really at loggerheads here. I mean, the medical community is divided on this.
Yeah. Paul Johnson's joining us from Global Television. You can see his report at globalnews.ca. He's joining us on Toronto Today on 640 Toronto. And I don't know whether it falls strictly along, you mentioned abortion, which often falls strictly along political lines. I see a larger Venn diagram with this based on people's anecdotal experiences, based on something they may have gone through in their family with addiction. I know, especially federally, there feels like there's an alignment. The liberals think this, the conservatives think that. But I just talk to people who don't get in front of microphones and aren't politicians. And I get a wide variety of opinions on this. Some are absolutely blow my mind. People who lean right on almost a lot of issues that think, oh, this is a great idea. And I see people who lean left more than right on issues saying we're making a big mistake here. I see all sides.
Yeah, it's much more complicated than just a traditional left-right axis. There's a lot of people who would identify as being members of the political right who say, I'm fine with this. We shouldn't be prosecuting drug users criminally for possession. We should be putting them into treatment. They're fine with that. I'm fine with safe supply. If we can give drug users drugs that won't kill them and they're under the care of their doctor, and as the saying goes, break the link between the user and the drug dealer and strengthen the link between the drug user and their doctor, they're for that. But what they are willing and what they are wanting to question and in many cases criticize is the way the government is carrying it out. Is the way that the government here in British Columbia is executing this is the right way to go? Was the decriminalization bill the right way to move forward with this? Actually wasn't a bill, it was an administrative decision. But is this the right thing to do? A few months ago, I went down to Oregon, to Portland. And Portland, the state of Oregon, about 2 years prior to BC's journey into decriminalization of hard drugs, they decriminalized there. And for many of the same reasons of you know, what was going on here in British Columbia, skyrocketing rates of overdose deaths, and they were wanting to do something. Their method of decriminalization was a little bit different, but essentially it's a very similar population demographically. It's a similar region. And so we went down there to see what has gone on. And we found that after 2 years of decriminalization of hard drugs, ostensibly to remove the stigma of criminality and hopefully get users to feel better about going into treatment, talking about what's going on with them, they thought that this would reduce the drug overdose deaths. The numbers came out a couple of months ago for 2022, and they were up by a vast margin again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, proponents of decriminalization would say they'd be way higher if we hadn't done decriminalization. Opponents say, look at this, more evidence this isn't working. Every metric, every time the coroner's service, either in the state of Oregon or here in British Columbia today, it seems every time they release their numbers, it's another tragedy. And those who support decriminalization and safe supply say, this means we need to double down on that. Those who oppose say, this isn't working, give your head a shake. And we're still not out of this.
Paul Johnson's a global BC reporter. I highly recommend, I urge you, run, don't walk. Do whatever you can to go to globalnews.ca and watch his story about open drug use and the opioid crisis on downtown Vancouver streets. Is this only a Vancouver story? No, I think it's a big city story. I think it's an important big city story, given it was just at the end of January. So they're barely 3 months in where they decriminalized all drugs. This seems to be a mayoral issue. I'd like it to become more of an issue, I suppose. And I think it's important to pin down these candidates, and especially the front runners. Okay, the Matlows, the Bylaws, the Chows, the Bradfords. Mark Saunders is pretty on the record about not wanting to decriminalize. He doesn't want to throw people in jail for drug arrests, but he doesn't want to decriminalize either. And I'll give you some data on the other side of this. But yeah, Paul Johnson was able to go around, do a remarkable story. I wouldn't have had the courage to do it, to basically be buying drugs in the open scene in Vancouver as a reporter. Didn't use them and didn't resell them or anything. But he told us in a chat I had with him yesterday that they are very, very accessible.
Well, there was in our little investigation that we did. Now, I should be clear. This doesn't have the weight of a peer-reviewed academic paper. Mm-hmm. This was a one-off daily news report where we very simply, we had heard this controversy, some saying the streets are awash right now with dealies. What they call Dilaudid pills, also known as hydromorphone, that had been prescribed under the BC Safe Supply Program to users, and they don't want them, or they had too many of them, or for whatever, so they resold them on the streets or traded them to get drugs that they want, presumably fentanyl because it's stronger. This was the lingo. So we wanted to see if this is true. Can I walk down to Maine and Hastings in Vancouver and see if you can buy dailies on the street? And so we went down last Friday. It was about 12 noon. And in about 25 minutes, I was able to buy 26 Dilaudid tablets for $30. So for a little bit more than a buck a pill, we got 26 Dilaudid tablets. We went to the testing facility that they have in that neighborhood, which is a free testing facility where people can go and get their drugs tested to find out if there's fentanyl in them or what's going on with them. They confirmed that they were, in fact, hydromorphone, Dilaudid. We also spoke with a doctor who is part of the Safe Supply Program, who took a look at the packaging because we had some unopened blister packs. And this doctor said, yep, those are the ones that come from our Safe Supply Program. So what we found was dillies were for sale. They were, in fact, actual dillies. They appeared to be similar to the ones that were part of the Safe Supply Program. Also, how else would dillies show up for sale on the streets? I mean, you can only get these through prescriptions. So what is the source of these? Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly. And we didn't claim to say we know exactly, but you can certainly get dillies on the street. And that was something that had been in question prior to that. There's been a lot of controversy about that.
How would you describe the streets? You're doing this in broad daylight. you know, because we hear things in Toronto and you'd be, you know, I love Vancouver like you wouldn't believe. And I was a boyhood Canucks fan, for lack of a better term.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I know. Frustrating times all around lately. Yeah. But I'd say this, you often hear in Toronto, of all places, we want to make sure we don't turn into Vancouver. That's a bold statement, but that's also a demonstrative statement from people who see footage. Give us a sense, three time zones away, what's real, what's exaggerated, what's imagined from you being on these streets and the drug trade.
Okay, well, Vancouver writ large is not some kind of zombie apocalypse, yeah. Post-civilizational hellscape. There is a part of town that has struggled for many years where there are complex socioeconomic, psychosocial problems. That's known as the downtown east side. It's a comparatively very small part of the city, but it's where some of the biggest problems are concentrated, namely an intersection of drug use, drug addiction, untreated mental health problems, and a fair bit of crime. And that's where we went. That's where this was going on. And for 30 years, this has been an area that has been known as a place where there is open drug sales happening. It's not happening everywhere in the city. Most parts of Vancouver don't have this going on. But in the part where we went, with respect to the dillies, there not only were dillies for sale, there was what seemed to be pretty clear to me, a robust aftermarket in these. Because as I was asking people if they had dillies for sale, people were then also asking me if I had dillies for sale because they wanted to buy from me.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't have that. And I mean, to me, what that showed is it's known that these pills are available down there and there's people going down there to both buy and sell. This appeared to be the existence of a robust aftermarket for a drug that is being prescribed by the government here.
Your report was fantastic, and it was awesome journalism. So thank you very much for sharing how you did it and your reaction to it and the subsequent reaction to it out there for us in Toronto. We appreciate it.
Okay, have a great show.
Last poll I saw, that's a remarkable report from Paul Johnson. Last poll I saw, BC, this is from Polling Canada, those who say the province is doing a poor job on housing affordability. Well, you and I might say every province is doing a lousy job on it right now. 83%. Poverty, homelessness, 80%. Drug use, opioid crisis, 73%. I don't know how we'd poll here in Ontario. It might be, it wouldn't possibly be as high as it is in BC. And a lot of people gave credit to the BC government. They pushed and tugged and pulled and they got Ottawa to give it a go to basically decriminalize small amounts of illicit drugs. But you just heard the data right there. The numbers are higher. They're worse. They're absolutely worse. And there's a lot of MPs and a lot of mayors in British Columbia saying they need a different approach because people are still dealing and people are still being violent and people are still robbing and people aren't getting clean. We're not getting people into treatment. We're allowing safe supply. We're not getting people help to stop the addiction.
This is Toronto Today with Greg Brady.
Toronto's news, today's talk.
640 Toronto.
Yesterday was a big announcement at Queen's Park, but it may be the first of some to come. There's a lot of regions that are getting examined. Simcoe region's going to, Durham region's going to. I've talked to friends in Kitchener-Waterloo. They're like, what's going to happen here? So a lot is up in the air. We want to welcome on the mayor of Caledon. By the way, she had a remarkable, remarkable line that's gone viral. We won't get her to repeat it, but it was great. I liked it. And she was elected as mayor with 58% of Caledon turning out to vote for her last fall. She is Annette Groves. Mayor Groves, thanks very much for the time today. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Greg, for having me this morning.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to tell you, when you start to type in your name, Annette Groves, to Google, Annette Groves' husband is the second. So, you know, like that's moved up in the charts a little bit. I don't know if other people have reached out to him, but we're only talking to you this morning. We only want your side of the story.
Well, thank you, Greg.
and they don't have Annette Groves' dog. Tell us about your dog. I'm a big dog lover. What's your dog like?
Oh, I have an amazing dog. We adopted him I adopted him for my son. My son was 9 years old. My son is now 21 years old. his name is Enzo, and he is a little Chihuahua Pekingese. So I adopted him from a foster home. He's an amazing, amazing dog with a great personality, loves people, and, he's the best friends with my son and Enzo are just best buddies.
I like that personal touch, and you taught your son responsibility at an early age. Yesterday's news conference was intriguing. Caledon, what are your residents telling you? I mean, what are they hopeful? Can this be seen as a positive for Caledon to gain independence and do your own thing while still not losing out on any of what's around you in Peel Region?
So it's a mixed, we've got mixed feelings in our community. Of course, the anxiety level is quite high because our future is now uncertain. And with the growth that we're scheduled to take over the next two decades, it's making many of my residents, including myself and members of council and our senior leadership team, a little concerned about how we're going to move forward in terms of funding the infrastructure that we need to support the growth that we're expected to take over the next two decades.
So let's check some boxes about what Caledon is, because I think it gives a great microcosm for people in their own communities. You run your own fire, right? There's a town of Caledon fire and emergency services. So this should be unaffected.
That's right. Fire is unaffected. We have Caledon OPP here, so we're not policed by Peel Regional Police. So that's not affected, but we certainly have a lot of services that the Region of Peel has provided over the last almost 50 years to Caledon, such as social services, health services, long-term care, affordable housing, supportive housing, garbage collection, water and wastewater. We've got 12 regional roads in Caledon that the Region of Peel maintains. So a number of services will be impacted because the region has been a great provider of these services for Caledon.
Ambulance services, I see, look like they're run by Peel Regional Paramedic Services. So do you have to do your own ambulances now out of your town budget in the future? What do you know about that?
Well, and I think these are early days, Greg. As this was just announced yesterday. And as I said yesterday, I am confident that this is not an announcement that came lightly or a decision that came lightly on the part of the province. The province knows the funding that we need in order to make all three municipalities whole. And the province has committed that they would make us whole. Mm. And so all of these things would be ironed out, I guess, in negotiated through the transition board that's being put in place right now.
Annette Groves is our guest mayor of Caledon, joining us on Toronto Today. It was referenced a bunch of times, which you heard, and I mean, they named it the Hazel McCallion Act. This is something the late former mayor of Mississauga had talked about, had wanted. Both Mississauga and Brampton have just grown exponentially, more in the 90s than in the last 10 years or so. But I'd ask you, when you ran for mayor last year, and you've given, two decades of service to Caledon, either as a councillor or now mayor, was this on your radar? Was this even in the back of your mind thinking this could happen over the next 4 years while I'm the mayor?
Absolutely. There's been conversations at the Region of Peel. This is their third. This is my third time going through this exercise. Mm-hmm. It started back in 2005 when the late Mayor McCallion started having those conversations with regards to separation. It was decided on by the Region of Peel's council, and Caledon's position has always been that the region has served us well, and we were never in favor of separation. So, it didn't come as a surprise. We knew that this would be a possibility, and now we have to deal with the reality.
I think it's a standard question to ask any head of a elected body. Housing. I want to know how much Caledon is growing. I see a population of 76,000 or so. Is there demand for more? By the way, you have that amazing, amazing golf course up there, right? TPC Osprey. Toronto at Osprey Valley. It's incredible. And so that's where you should go for your golf vacations, everybody. Don't get on an airplane. Go to Caledon for a golf vacation. Sure. Eat out, restaurant, stay near there, have a great time. And anyway, what's your housing demand?
What? Caledon is absolutely a beautiful place. You really don't need to go anywhere for your vacation. We've got so many beautiful places here in Caledon. But with respect to growth, Greg, we are expected to grow exponentially over the next two decades. We're expected to take grow from, you know, just under 80,000 to 300,000 over the next two decades. We're also expected to provide 13,000 affordable housing units over the next 8 years. And we've signed our pledge as required by the province, that we are pledging to bring on those 13,000 affordable housing units over the next 8 years. So with that said, we are and will be in need of a whole lot of dollars to provide the infrastructure to accommodate that type of growth.
I hear it. I got about a minute here. Peel District School Board will stay intact. I suppose that gives people an element of relief to some extent because it runs efficiently. It serves close to 200,000 students. And if you're bringing on that many new houses, there's going to be parents with kids that'll, like your son, like my kids, like lots of our listeners' kids, will go through the system. So is it a relief that the school board stays together?
I think so. I think that is a relief for the school boards. And again, you know, I am very concerned about how we're going to accommodate and afford the growth that we're expected to take over the next two decades. But again, as I said yesterday, I am confident that the province will be stepping up. We've got Minister Jones, the Deputy Premier, as our MPP, and Minister Jones will certainly be there alongside us advocating for our fair share at Queen's Park. And I am very confident that the Premier will certainly ensure that Caledon gets its fair share out of this whole deal.
Well, I know you'll be a superb voice for your people. It's lovely to have you on the show. Let's stay on this file, and I hope you have a great long weekend. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much, Greg, and happy Victoria Day weekend to you as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. There's Annette Grove. She's the mayor of Caledon. That's really interesting to get that lens. Did you hear that statement about the growth? They're talking about Caledon going from 65,000-70,000 people to over 200,000. That's the expectation. So where does the infrastructure come from? What do you need from that point on? More retail, more transit, more stores, a gym, a restaurant, tons of stuff, parking lots. You need a lot more than a smaller town can provide at the moment.
This is Toronto Today with Greg Brady.
Toronto's news, today's talk.
640 Toronto.
Are you in or out?
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
So are we in or out? You're out. You are over and out.
No. You insulted him a little bit.
I'm okay with it, but now you're making me feel weird about it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
All right, and our in-out is all about this.
I don't know why they call this stuffed hamburger helper. It does just fine by itself, huh? I like it better than tuna helper myself. Don't you, Clark?
You're the gourmet around here, Ed.
I'm a huge Cousin Eddie fan. All right, so it's charcoal versus gas grills. And Sheba, you and I want to give Gord the floor, I think, because he's on Team Charcoal in the summer.
He's a king barbecuer. He's Mr. Barbecue.
Yeah, I mean, just follow his social media. It's endless. It's an endless stream of things on grills.
And beer, and that's about it.
Well, that's it, too.
That's it. I'm very shallow.
And if you get to Nashville again, like you do a video tour of Graceland.
Absolutely.
Why do you prefer it? This wouldn't have even been a debate in 1986, but gas grills now are more popular. But why are you old school, and why do you prefer charcoal?
It's just you're more involved in it. It's the gas grill, the propane, which I also have, but it's just you put it on and forget it. If you're making burgers, propane all the way. But if you're doing something like ribs or kebabs or something.
Why?
Just the flavor is better.
It's got a smoky flavor that I admit gas doesn't give you.
And you can throw some wood chips in there if you really want to enhance the smoky flavor. Just throw them right on the grill, on the charcoal. And you got to build the fire. You got to tend it. You got to be more involved than just walking away.
My neighbor has it, and he documents that when even some of the drippings, if you will, fall on the coals, you get a bit of a flavor.
Absolutely.
Flavor coal, whereas with a gas grill, it just goes nowhere. It just becomes slime.
It just turns into black smoke. It's not good.
Yeah. All right. So Gord is in on charcoal grills. Would you ever say, it's too much too much bother, and the briquettes are heavy.
I just bought a new one a couple weeks ago.
Yes, I saw the picture of it.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
I'm told by a listener you can charcoal grills reach a higher temperature faster than gas grills. You know how you got to close the lid with gas and wait it out a little bit. If you like your meat black, come to the Brady
House.
It's
like driving a manual car. You're more involved in it, in the driving of it, than automatic.
How am I supposed to eat a Baconator while coming from a workout, which is... never mind. all right, so in or out, charcoal grills. You heard Gord make his case. They're actually cheaper as well. I did not know that.
They are
moderately priced compared to the gas. I mean, people can spend like $1,000 on a really great gas grill.
Oh, no, you're closer to two. You're in the $15,000 to $2,000 for a good name brand. You can get a name brand like a Weber, like I got for $200 for a gas grill, a little circular guy, and it's perfect.
So, Sheba, you're officially out because you don't have... I think we're out because we don't have one.
No, but I've had one before, and I'm out on this because I prefer the gas barbecue. I think it's just more convenient. It's... the ease of use, the speed of it, the exact reason that you love your charcoal barbecue, Gord, is why I love my gas, because it's really quick. The heat is evenly distributed. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm not the main barbecuer in our house, but every time I use it, it's just so much easier.
416-870-6400. Gas grill. Gord says charcoal. Are you in or out on the charcoal grill? We'll read some of your best texts. It'll make us hungry before 9 o'clock. Let's get inside the newsroom. 728. Gas.
Yeah,
charcoal.
I'm a gas guy.
Yeah, you have been?
I respect Gord for his barbecue knowledge.
And that's about it.
No, for everything else. But,
yes, of course.
But yeah, I just find the convenience of gas, like Sheba, is just... it outweighs the charcoal.
Charcoal, you can kind of see when you're running out, too. When you turn that propane on and nothing comes out, and then you wiggle the tank and you know it's empty, it's soul-sucking.
I have a tank with a little gauge on it.
You're better on better man than me for that.
It's fantastic.
And you need a spare.
Oh, yeah, I have a spare, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.